And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and is also brought to you in part by the Piney Woods Audubon Society in Nacogdoches, Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information is on Facebook at East Texas Piney Woods Audubon. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends tonight and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back to Bird Calls.
Hey, Bill. Welcome to you too on this coolish June evening.
Yeah, we might get some rain out there tonight, which will give the birds a little water there since it's been dry here recently.
Yes.
I'm sure they could use that. Again, we ask you to call in tonight at 800-552-8502 with any questions about our avian world. That's 800-552-8502. And also, if you have a photo to send to Cliff and you'd like him to identify the bird, you can send it to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. So, Cliff, it's hard to believe we're celebrating 5 years of this show. Man, time has passed by.
We're not a little nestling anymore. We're more of a fledgling, if not an adult bird show now, right?
I feel like I've been kicked out of the nest, so yeah. I think I'm already flying.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, this show was born 5 years ago, June of 2013 we started, and we didn't really know how it would be received. I remember that we thought, okay, maybe there'll be enough interest to do this quarterly.
Right.
And after the first episode, we got bombarded with questions. And I remember that night because we said, oh my gosh, we've got to do this every other month. And
right.
So we quickly did move it to six times a year. And then it kept rolling and steamrolling. And now we are monthly.
Mm-hmm.
So it has evolved into, I think, a really informative, fun show. We have a good time. We have a lot of listeners that are faithful, and we thank them for being faithful listeners. And we have a lot of people to thank, because this show would not make it just from our two voices on the air.
Right.
There's a lot of behind the scenes. And I want to first of all thank this station, Red River Radio, and the general manager, Kermit Poling, for believing in this show and maintaining it. Kudos to that. Kudos to you, Bill, because you're not just the voice. There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff you're doing that people don't realize. And I've mentioned it before on air that you're fiddling with all these buttons. I'm just sitting here answering questions, but you're patching through collars. You're pulling up our bird songs and bird calls that we play. So kudos to you, Bill, for all that behind-the-scenes stuff that you're doing. Several other people I want to thank. We use fantastic photographs from James Childress of Lufkin. And you can go to our Red River Radio webpage, and each month we profile a species, and James has graciously given us photos to use for each of those profiled species. So I encourage you to look at his photographs. We'll mention him here in a minute when we profile this episode's species. Of course, I have to thank my wife, Julie, for her assistance. She helps me out a lot with ideas and wording and guidance on where we need to go with this. She's not only my wife, she's a heck of a biologist too, so it's really nice to have her to lean on and for assistance. So thanks to Julie. Other thanks, the website Xenocanto, that's where I get most of our bird calls, bird songs that we use. That's spelled Xenocanto, and it is a fantastic website, just full of fantastic recordings that we use on the air. So thanks to Xenocanto.org. All our faithful listeners in the Red River Radio listening area and beyond, we've fielded calls from Maine to Idaho. Mm-hmm. So we have people that are streaming this online elsewhere outside the listening area, and we thank everybody that's been listening and that's faithfully listening and also faithful contributors to the radio station here. I want to thank my agency, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, for allowing me time to do this important and wide-reaching outreach event, this radio show. In fact, Texas Parks and Wildlife did a video last year about this radio show.
Still on our website.
Yep, and if you want to see what we look like and see how the layout looks like of the radio show, because since we're just voices on the air, go to YouTube, and there's an 8-minute video that's really well done by Parks and Wildlife. Just search on YouTube for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Birdman from East Texas, and you'll get a visual about this radio show. I think is really important to see. And so also we have a important behind-the-scenes group in our phone bank. And so, Bill, tell us about the phone bank and who we need to thank.
Well, we've had a lot of people back there answering phones for this show. Wally Derleth is our key man back there. He's the one who writes to me on our little interface device here and tells me who the callers are and where they're calling from. Also, Henry Edwards, Tim Schnell, Sheila Lawrence, Susan Fletcher, Jim Neal, Susan Bettinger, and Renee Moran have all helped out on the production of this show in one way or the other, and they are a crucial part of this. All of our volunteers, and Renee, of course, and Henry are part of staff, but the rest are well, Wally's part of staff too, but yeah, the rest are volunteers, and they come in just to help us out because of their support of this station, and we're very grateful.
Yeah, and I liken them to air traffic controllers. You know, they're basically telling all these callers to stand by, you're number three on the waiting list, and they get people, they chat with the people and get them kind of, you know, turn your radio off when you're calling and all that good stuff. So there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes that people don't hear while we're on the air. And so we're taking this time in our 5-year anniversary tonight to welcome these folks and to have them continue helping us. And we want to really thank them for helping keep this show alive.
Absolutely. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We hope you'll call in tonight on our 5-year anniversary, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is our resident ornithologist, and he'll help answer your questions about birds, birding, and our avian world. And we had a call last month from a caller who said they were hearing something that had a cat-like meow. And so you've done some research on this. What have you come up with?
Yeah, there are two candidates, and we're going to play those here in just a second. There are two birds in our listening area that kind of give a cat-like meow, and one of them is appropriately named the gray catbird. So let's listen to that.
Now, I would swear I hear that in my neighborhood, but I sometimes wonder whether it's a squirrel, you know, shrieking. It's hard for me to tell the difference.
Yeah, or a kitty cat. So that's the gray catbird. That's the call note of the gray catbird. It has a very elaborate song, somewhat reminiscent of a mockingbird because they are a mimic, so they imitate things. And so the other bird that also gives this cat-like meow is the yellow-breasted chat. We'll hear two examples.
That's got more of a meow, almost.
Like a baby kitty.
Yeah, exactly.
A kitten. And we have a second example because it's variable. Let's listen.
Almost kind of reminds me of a blue jay, but not quite.
No, it the first one, especially of the chat, really sounds cat-like to me. And I think that caller, I really liked that caller brought that up, that he hears that. Let's see, that was Gary and Dieball. I keep notes.
Mm-hmm.
And so thanks to Gary for bringing that up last month. And I spent some time finding these recordings to hopefully answer his question and maybe other people's questions of, hey, I keep hearing this meowing in the woods. So the catbird is going to be more in an urban setting. It would be a backyard bird. The chat is going to be more in old fields or regenerating pine clear cuts.
Right.
So it's going to be a little bit more rural. So when you're out in the countryside, you probably have a better chance of seeing or hearing the yellow-breasted chat. So at least we've narrowed it down to, you know, those two candidates. If you do ever hear a you're positive it's a bird and it's not a kitty cat and it's making a meow-like sound, it's either, again, the gray cat bird or the yellow-breasted chat.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We invite you to call in during tonight's show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about our avian world is welcome tonight. And at the end of last month's show, you gave us a conservation tip. Can you refresh our memories about that?
Yeah, we talked about open vertical pipes and how they're all around us. They're attached to our homes and our buildings. They're in ag fields. They're in mining operations. They're at construction sites. It's basically fence posts and metal pipes that are set up vertically that don't have a cap on it. There are a lot of birds that are curious, and especially cavity nesting birds will sit on there. Things like bluebirds and kestrels, they'll sit on those, and they might go down in there, and they can't shimmy their way back out. That it might be a pole that's made of metal that's slick, or PVC that's a temporary vertical pipe that's very slick. And so the bird community in the last decade have found that there are a lot of bird deaths because of this, and it should be avoided. And so what I mentioned is that I've gone through my yard and my house to avoid having these open pipes. I mentioned last month that I had three pipes on the roof of my house that didn't have caps on them. They're mm-hmm. air vents, and I just put some hardware cloth and a hose clamp and eliminated that possibility. Also, no roaches are falling in. That's another way they can get in the house, I suppose. But I kind of liken it to baby-proofing. You know, we baby-proof our house for our kids. We even baby-proof our house and our yard for our pets. You know, we make sure there's not dangers for our cats and dogs right. and our children. And it's not much more of a step forward to do the same for critters. So cap those open vertical pipes if you've got them. That way you won't have these unwanted deaths that are just totally unnecessary. It's just awful to think that these birds fall in there, can't get out, and they die a slow, painful death. You know, probably sitting in there for a couple days, and that's just an awful thought. So, and I do this with other things. You know, with I turn buckets over upside down, pickle buckets and things I use in the lawn, because I've seen lizards fall in, green anoles, and they fall in and die. And that's horrible. So I turn buckets over. That's another idea here of kind of baby-proofing for wildlife. Because I like the green anoles, those green lizards that can turn brown, because they're eating pesky insects. So I like having them around. I don't want them to die accidentally. Mm-hmm. No one likes to see something die like that. So think about doing that, removing open vertical pipes on your property or your work site by capping those open vertical pipes so birds can't fall in.
Now we get to the next part of our show, which is our profile species. Can you tell us what we're going to profile this week?
Yes, this month we're going to profile the chimney swift. This species emits non-musical chattering and twittering high above our heads as heard here.
Very thin sound, but very high-pitched.
Yep. And those are multiple individuals. Let's keep listening. Yeah, not very musical, not very exciting, but you'll hear that above you as you're in your yard or in town. This bird is usually seen while in flight, has a cigar-shaped body, short tail, and overall it's a dull gray-brown plumage. Its flight is on stiff wings, it's very acrobatic, and may appear bat-like to some observers. These birds occur in rural settings, but they're most abundant in urban settings thanks to chimneys that we'll talk about more at the very end of the show, so don't change that radio channel. Swifts are closely related to hummingbirds, not swallows, not martins, which forage for winged insects in a similar manner. Due to the strange toe arrangement of chimney swifts, where all four toes point forward, swifts cannot grasp a limb or wire like most birds, but instead they cling to a rough vertical surface of wood, brick, or stone. These birds start arriving in the Red River Radio listening area in mid to late March, and they spend the warmer months with us. The species occurs throughout the eastern half of the U.S., east of the Rocky Mountains, and north into southern Canada. In fall, when the temperatures turn cold and aerial insects begin to disappear, all of these birds retreat south to Latin America. The chimney swift's wintering grounds are poorly known, but they were completely unknown until the 1950s, when a leg band that was placed on a chimney swift was recovered in eastern Peru near the headwaters of the Amazon River in about 1953-ish. A missionary saw a native wearing a necklace adorned with a few aluminum leg bands from birds, and one of these bands turned out to belong to a chimney swift that was banded in the U.S. The chimney swift's nest is most interesting as it's made of tiny twigs stuck together and placed on the inside of a hollow tree or a chimney by the bird's saliva. That's right, the bird's spit, once dry, becomes a natural adhesive like glue. Since usually aloft and not very colorful, this is not the most photogenic species, but we still have a photo snapped by James Childress of Lufkin, so look for it on our bird calls page at redriverradio.org.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now. We'd love to hear from you. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we've had a number of submitted images and some questions. And we're going to start off with Deborah Bird Rayford from Brunson, South Carolina, who submitted three images to you of the same bird. Mm-hmm. The images are a little bit blurry, but birds don't like to really stand still and be photogenic all the time. So she said she'd seen this strange bird sighting and they had tentatively identified it, but they weren't sure. Her husband first spotted it and initially thought it was a quail since it was wandering along the open ground into mm-hmm. the pine woods. Its cute white tail, bright yellow beak, and they saw it one more time the same day and got some pictures of it, but they have not seen it since then.
Yeah, and thank goodness for photos. Even these are a little fuzzy. You wouldn't see these on a cover of a magazine by any shot, but they're still good enough for me and for us to look at. And they're of a sora. It's a rail that is very common, even in our listening area. This caller or this person wrote in from, as you said, South Carolina. So that's right. Pretty cool that we've got faithful listeners that far away. And yes, this is a sora, and it's something you can see in our listening area in migration. And sometimes in the winter, they like marshy habitat, so edges of small lakes that might have marsh grass and things lining it. That's a great place for it. Mucky areas. So the sora is not very big. It does look kind of like a quail, as was mentioned, and they do have a bright yellow bill. And again, it's one of the rails. So cousins would be, if you've ever heard of a king rail or a clapper rail or a Virginia rail or a yellow rail, those are other examples of rails. And this one is simply called the sora. It's only name, you know, it's only got one word name, kind of like Prince and Madonna right. and Cher. So it must be a pretty special bird, huh, if it's got one name.
Yeah, I'm stuck with two names, but, you know, that's okay. So it's a beautiful bird. I mean, it looks quite big, and it looks from the photographs quite colorful. So does it have...
Yeah, it's a lot of earth tone gray and black and brown, so it blends into the ground. The bright yellow bill really sticks out.
Yeah.
But he's not very large. He's like a skinny quail. If you think of a quail, they're right. kind of plumpish. He's about that size, but skinnier, and he's not going to be out in the dry grassland with a quail. He's going to be in that marshy, mucky habitat.
And you may have said this. I was up checking something, but the bill looks like a nut-cracking bill.
It's a heavy bill, and they do eat a lot of invertebrates and vertebrates alike that they can use that bill to crack open maybe a tough exoskeleton of something, like a crawfish.
Okay. Yeah. You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have one more quick online question that came to us, and that was from Kelly Pears, who's down at the Alexandria Museum of Art. Folks, go visit that museum down there. It's quite beautiful. And she asked a simple question. Why do doves hang out on the concrete in the evening?
Yeah, and I see that a lot. I think a lot of people see them on the sides of roads, and I think what they're doing is getting grit, G-R-I-T, little bitty pebbles of cement, rock, because when you're a seed eater like a mourning dove, you need to have grit in your muscular crop to help grind those seeds. And so I think you see that a lot with mourning doves, more so than with other birds, and they're looking for grit, because that doesn't, you know, there's no reason why they'd be out on a parking lot looking for seeds or food when it's a wasteland. So, but there are important little pieces of rock and grit for them to use for digestion.
And this is part of their gizzard that basically goes into.
So
those of you who eat gizzards, you understand.
Yeah, that's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our first caller tonight. Aubrey, and I'm not sure where you're from, Aubrey, but tell us where you're from, and you are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Thank you. I'm from Shreveport. My question to Dr. Shackelford is about bird calls. Is there any rhythm, messages, or sequences, or repetitive things that birds sing to themselves or to each other? In other words, is there any regularity and sort of repetitive stories told in bird songs?
That's an interesting question. So, of course, we don't know precisely what they're saying, but we know that bird song is used for several things. And to maybe answer your question, the repetitiveness of a male singing is namely to mark and maintain a territory. In other words, he's shouting to everybody that this is his area. We put up fences and barbed wire to mark our boundaries of our property, but birds use voice. They also are vocalizing to attract a mate or to maintain a mate. You'll hear things like pileated woodpeckers that are paired up, and they might separate by 100 yards. But they'll stay in communication with each other. You'll hear one vocalize as if to say, "Honey, are you okay?" And the other one calls back and says, "Sure, I'm right over here." So it's very easy to make this anthropomorphic, but the general rule is what I'm, the two themes is for maintaining a territory and for keeping the pair bond together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Aubrey.
Right. Bye-bye.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call in now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Mark from Shreveport. Mark, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you, this morning in a post on Facebook, I live in Broadmoor, a lady had posted that she found two dead hawks on a certain street, and mm-hmm. she was curious while they possibly died. She said a mosquito truck had sprayed earlier in the evening, and then in the morning she found these two hawks dead on her street. So I was just kind of curious, could that kind of mosquito spray possibly kill a hawk?
Well,
is that a possibility? I wouldn't think so.
I think that there's, this word coincidence that we can probably apply to this scenario, because we're talking about birds that often are attracted to road edges, and they'll fly across a road and get hit. Some of our hawks will scavenge just like a vulture, and it could be picking off of a roadkill. And something
right.
flushes it, and it flies in front of the windshield of a vehicle. So, no, I don't think that a mosquito truck is going to be an issue. I think it's going to be other forces. Because if you drive around like I do, I drive, I don't know, with work, 15,000-plus miles a year, plus personal. And I'm a bird person, so I'm looking. And I see a lot of dead hawks and owls on our roadsides. It's very unfortunate, but it's because they're just like two-year-olds. They don't mix with traffic. And it's hard to tell your two-year-old kid, don't walk out in traffic. Well,
right.
It's the same problem with birds. They just don't realize that big truck is going to hurt. So I'm calling coincidence here, Mark, and I'm going to say that it's probably due to vehicular difficulties, or not difficulty,
okay.
but vehicular traffic.
Sounds like a good explanation to me. So,
yeah.
Okay, well, Well, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Enjoy the show. I really enjoy the show.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thank you, Mark. I was curious whether the fog might affect their flight, though. You know, if it was coming up as they were doing a dive down, could that distort their vision?
I've seen those foggers down on the coast of Texas. They usually do them at dusk or at dawn. Raptors aren't typically flying. The plume goes away pretty quickly. I think it's silly that we're having to do that. I think we're creating the problem. I've mentioned this before on the show with our elevated roads, and we have these what we call borrow ditches that are on the side of the road, what some people call bar ditches. That's just a weird way of losing the term borrow ditch. It turns into bar ditch. Anyway, those fill up with water, right, and they don't flood or flush, and it sits there and it becomes stagnated, and we're creating the mosquito problem.
Right. They become the mosquito problem, and that brings in the birds and other things that want to eat the mosquitoes.
And especially on the coast where, you know, everything's just barely above sea level. There's not much relief. It's very flat, and water just doesn't flow away. So, and I mentioned on a previous show that we can maintain our own yard. We have to make sure our gutters are clean, that we don't have buckets collecting water. We don't have even a coffee cup, just a simple little coffee cup that you get for free at the gas station, just half full. That can provide enough water for, dozens of mosquitoes to bloom and become a problem. So it's a human-created problem, and we should do better.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are tied up right now. We've got Anna on hold. Please stay with us. George, Bob, and Johnny are also on hold. But we've got another Bob right now who happens to be a trucker. Either that or he's from Trucker. And he is online right now. Bob, what's your question?
Oh, yes, I am a trucker. Good evening, gentlemen.
Kind of figured
Thank
that.
I'm on the way just about to Lafayette. Congratulations on your fifth year, by the way.
Hey, great. Thank you. There's no emerald or anything with that. No coin or, there's gold and silver and diamond. I don't think we get anything.
There's only the yellow brick road.
Yeah. We'll take a wood chip. How about that?
Okay. I had a question for Mr. Shackelford, if he could maybe take a guess at it. I live in north central Texas, and I was on the porch recently and spotted a bird that I'd never seen before.
Okay.
And it kind of shaped like a female cardinal, the physical shape of it, but it had what appeared to be, I grabbed the binoculars, but of course the trees are all leafed out and it's hard to see, but it appeared to be a dark blue or dark purple head and neck, and then the backside had a vibrant green patch on its back, and then the rest after the green patch looked similar to a female cardinal coloring, but it had a robin breast. Like a robin.
Wow, you pretty much perfectly described a male painted bunting. And so write that down, Bob. Painted bunting, and next time you're don't do this while you're driving your truck. Don't do Google Images while you're driving. But when you pull over to gas up, look up painted bunting, and you describe perfectly a male painted bunting, and that's quite a treat to have seen. And they're there in north central Texas. It's not unusual for the location, but it's still always exciting to see it. So I'm glad you got to see that. And that's a beauty. What'd you think? Beautiful, wasn't it?
There were two and maybe three of them fluttering around. That one lit in the tree, and that's when I grabbed the binoculars. And fortunately, he sat there long enough for me to get a pretty good look at it.
Well, that's great. And, you're in a great business to be a bird watcher, mm-hmm, because you're on the road a lot, and you get to go to cool places, and you get to drive out of north central Texas, out of that Blackland Prairie country, and into, if you're headed to Lafayette, you've already passed through the Piney Woods, and now you're headed to the coastal plain. coastal prairies, rather. So you're in several different ecoregions just on your one drive. So,
I'm all over.
Hopefully, you've got a pair of binoculars there in your truck and can look at birds.
I do.
Good.
Yeah, so
cool.
I've got them regular.
Excellent.
I'm talking about the hawks a while ago. I had the misfortune of an owl hitting my windshield down west of San Antonio one night.
Uh-huh.
Scared the heck out of me. I didn't know what it was.
West of San Antonio? Okay, probably.
On I-10,
yeah. Yeah, right. Could have been a great horned, could have been a barn owl.
Right.
You know, those are the two dominant ones. Did it crack the windshield?
No, I thought it was going to knock. Man, it hit it so hard, you know. But in the middle of the night, that's nothing out there. And then all of a sudden, wham. And then,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, sorry to hear that. But keep looking at those birds, Bob.
I will, and thank you for that information.
Thank you.
I named it the Guatemalan Firebird. I told my wife it was the Guatemalan Firebird.
Yeah.
Come up from a volcano.
That's a good name for the painted bunny.
She laughed at me.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time and the information.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate it. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. We've got quite a few calls online. We're going to go next to Anna. I'm not sure where Anna is from, but you're online with Cliff, Anna. And where are you from?
Oh, I'm from Nacogdoches, Texas.
Okay.
And during the last week, I was at Lake Nakanish with my grandson in the fishing pier area. And while he was scooping up minnows with his bare hands, I was watching an almost steady stream of what I think might have been cattle egrets just cruising down low over the lake in the evening, over the dam, which would probably be sort of in a southeasterly direction is my guess. And I'm just curious if those were cattle egrets. And why were so many of them moving the whole time I was there?
So that's it. Probably they were probably cattle egrets, and in the evening you can see them headed to roost. A roost is where they're sleeping, and cattle egrets roost communally. And this time of the year they roost at the what we call a rookery or a heronry. And that's also where they're nesting. So they've got babies back home, and they're coming back. You know, the male and female take turns going out to look for food, so they have to sometimes fly many miles from the nest to fill up and bring food back. So at dusk, there's one last chance to go out and in the evening and get go out for groceries and come back, and you were just seeing all the birds going to roost. And that would be interesting to note where that roost was. Somebody knows where it is, because when you get thousands and thousands of cattle egrets and little blue herons and great egrets and several other species, they're pretty obvious. It's a big congregation of birds. So somewhere around there is going to be that rookery or heronry. Those are kind of synonymous terms. So pretty cool that you saw the cattle egrets. Now, did the little one look at the birds too, or was he too busy playing in the water?
Only because I pointed it out several times.
Yeah.
But he was really preoccupied with the baby catfish and minnows.
Oh, yeah.
Catching up with his hands.
Yeah. And that's...
I've been on the lake many times in the evening, but I've just never seen almost a constant stream of birds just cruising down the lake like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you get near a known heronry and you're on the highway, you can sometimes it's just like... I don't know, like people going flooding into church on a Sunday before church starts. Just tons of birds piling in. They're trying to beat the sun going down, trying to get back to the roost site. So on the road, I see it a lot, and some places I pulled over at that one moment where, you know, there's maybe a 15-minute window where there are just so many birds pouring in. There's also, I didn't mention white ibis. That's another one that we have in great numbers, which we didn't 20, 30 years ago. That's a bird that's really expanded and also jumps in with these other birds that I mentioned and roost and nest communally in these rookeries. So pretty cool. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
And that's down on Lake Nakanish, and there's a great pavilion down there built by the Timber Framers Guild. Good friend of the station, Tim Chauvin, was part of that project.
That's a serious one, too. I mean, I think you could probably drive a Mack truck on it. It's not wide enough, but it looks strong enough to hold a big truck. So I've been there many times. My son has fished near there, and that's a great spot to look for red-headed woodpeckers. There's still a lot of snags out in the reservoir. It's still a fairly young reservoir, Lake Nakanich, and there are so many red-headed woodpeckers out there. It's a really neat spot to see that bird.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We've got most of our lines tied up right now, but we have one open if you'd like to call in now, or you can wait a few minutes. We go next to George, Latou from Lake Louisiana. I'm not sure of your last name, George, but welcome to the show, and what's your question? Hello, George?
Hello?
Yes, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
That's me. That's Gerard Dupuy.
Okay.
Oh, Gerard.
Gerard Dupuy.
Well, they spelled it George Latou.
on beautiful Lotto Lake, Louisiana.
Well, you must know what a dogri is and a grosbec and
tout ça. Hey, lately we've been having some of them Caesar tail flycatchers.
Yeah.
In late summer.
Uh huh.
I never saw that before. You know.
Yeah, that's a beauty, isn't it?
Oh man, they got that aerial acrobats.
Yeah.
After the bugs.
Yeah, and seeing them at dusk or in the evening, the colors are really nice. They have a beautiful peachy side to them, and that's just an elegant bird to watch. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Gerard, I want to know when you're cooking, because you sound like if you know dogri and grosbec, you probably know how to cook.
Oh, don't have me calls. Yeah, I can make a good jambalaya and a good stewed goo.
I'll be there tomorrow night. How about that?
Satyapati. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Oh, man.
You know, I wanted to tell you a little folklore story about Cajun.
Okay.
Cajun, early French explorers.
All right.
The word has it that when they were exploring early Louisiana, that they had seen that, I believe it's a pileated woodpecker, that big one.
Yep.
Just saw one.
That's correct.
They said that they saw them and they were running out. They didn't have any food. They were starving.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, it's known in the Cajun French as a poule à modas.
Oh,
poule means chicken.
I don't know that
Moras
one.
Modas is chicken.
Uh-huh.
And Modas was one of the explorers.
Uh-huh.
And so, I don't know if it was Mr. Modas or another explorer, Monsieur. He shot, one of them shot the bird and killed it.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of stopped them with their starvation. They had a supper that night.
Yeah.
And fricassee.
Huh.
And so, they're not too, I wouldn't recommend them good to eat. And they're unlawful to kill. But anyway.
That's right.
They were starving in early French country there.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
in the 1700s.
Neat.
Yeah.
Well, I love your accent, Gerard, and we appreciate your call, sir.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Enjoy your program.
Great. All thank right. you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we're going to go to our next caller, Bob from Benton. As soon as I can get you up here, Bob. Bob, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Okay. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I'm like the other Bob we called earlier. I'm also a truck driver.
All right.
And I mainly drive from Shreveport to Dallas or Little Rock to Jackson, Mississippi. And my question is when I was a kid, you could pretty well identify a lot of the birds. They were regular birds around town. But now, 40 years later, I've noticed a lot of different species of birds that are showing up that I had never seen before, except maybe in other areas, like maybe Dallas. And one of them, I don't know the name of this bird, but it's a blackbird that has a really long tail.
Mm-hmm.
And you find them a lot around the parking lots, maybe like at Walmart and the
right.
shopping areas.
Right.
And another bird, which I was a dove hunter for a lot of years, and we always just shot the basic morning doves or the migrating dove out of South America. Mm-hmm. But now sometimes we wind up shooting these extra large doves. Mm-hmm. I don't know the name of them either. But my question is can we expect this more and more since the weather's changed and things like El Nino and everything all these scientists are talking about?
Well, let's talk about the two birds that you mentioned that went unnamed. The first one, the blackbird with the long tail, that's the great-tailed grackle.
Okay.
That's with a G, grackle. And those are, you know, those are really tied to urban settings. You can look at the literature. Even 80 years ago in Texas, they were not found north of the valley in South Texas, along the Rio Grande River. And,
right.
and slowly you could see in the literature how they inched their way north to San Antonio. And
right.
as Texas got more urbanized, that bird exploded starting in the 50s. So,
right, I agree.
And
I
so
agree.
Your second bird is the Eurasian collared dove. You talked about a jumbo, new jumbo-sized dove in our area. That's the Eurasian collared dove. It's not native. It was brought in and has naturalized on its own. It's expanding on its own. So to answer your question, can we see more changes? I think the answer is yes, if you're urbanized. If you're a bird that does well in cities, I think we could see more of this. But
yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah. So
one other thing real quick.
Okay.
I heard one of your callers talking about, you know, having seen some hawks dead and things like that. Being a truck driver, I think the greatest enemy for hawks are, you know, of course, of vehicles and 18-wheelers and so. And I think what I've noticed is that when a hawk is sitting usually on the line, they're looking down for rodents and so forth
yeah.
to eat.
Yeah.
And what happens is that they forget about the traffic, and they zig when they should have zagged. And
yes.
They're hit and killed. And
right.
what a terrible sight. I used to count the hawks from Natchitoches, Louisiana, to Shreveport each and every morning on my run back from Lake Charles. And I just took a lot of pride in counting them and trying to keep up with them, because normally when you see one, you go down another 100 yards and you'll see its mate.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
What a shame. What a shame to lose such a majestic bird.
Right.
That's terrible.
And I've mentioned that about the hawk sitting on posts. That we've had callers say, why are they watching traffic? And they're not. You nailed it. They're watching for rodents that are in that thick grass along our roadsides, our rights of way.
Right.
And I remember an episode, not an episode of the show, but an incident at work where we got called from at Parks and Wildlife. We got a call from the Panhandle where there was an incredible amount of dead barn owls on a certain stretch of highway. Well, doing a little research, I found out that everything around there had been plowed. There was no vegetation, and the only good vegetation was along the roadside in that part of the county. And I guess all the rodents had flooded there, and so the owls were after the rodents, and they were too close to the road. They got hit. So they asked for a solution. I said, get in there with bush hogs and scalp that grass. And they're looking at me like, what are you talking about? Why would you do that? Well, if you're telling me the owls are attracted to this area, it's because that grass is tall, because it's got rodents, and these birds have a better shot of getting evicted, move somewhere else, instead of continue to get killed because of the vegetation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So,
thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call, Bob.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And I believe we lost one of our callers, so we're going to go to the next one, who is Clyde from Nacogdoches. Clyde, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Actually, it's an identification question. I saw a group, like four or five of them,
mm-hmm.
vultures.
Okay.
And I believe the field mark is a black head and neck. You've got a black vulture or Mexican vulture.
Okay.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of static.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
And a red, let's see if I can get closer to the...
That's better.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a little closer to the...
The receiver.
Receiver.
Yeah.
and the then you've got one that's got a redhead neck that's, you know, about the same size or a little bigger, and that's a
turkey vulture, right?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't think I have ever seen both a black vulture and a turkey vulture together.
Uh-huh.
But just off Virginia Avenue, there were probably about four or five black vultures, and then one redheaded went in there along with the
group. Yep.
You know, getting at something in the grass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where that little creek crosses Virginia out mm-hmm. of John Anderson's place
mm-hmm.
and on some of the grass in there. Is that as unusual as I reacted to it?
No.
That's something that's
no.
common.
It's not unusual at all. You can find roadkill or, you know, piles of fish at cleaning stations with both species of vultures sharing.
Okay.
The black vulture tends to be more aggressive. You'll see them sometimes getting bigger numbers, and they push and shove, and the turkey vulture's a little bit more timid. And then they find their prey differently. So turkey vulture is usually the first on the scene. They're using the sense of smell to find their prey, whereas black vultures use sight. And actually, black vultures kind of cheat, because not only are they looking for dead stuff, they're also looking for where the turkey vultures are circling. And they'll come in and tag along. So you will see two species together, and you nailed it, Clyde, with the one with the red head is the turkey vulture, and the one with the gray head is the black vulture, and they can't occur together.
I just can't recall ever seeing, you know, every time I see a bunch of them on something, it's either all turkey vultures
yeah.
or all black vultures. I was
yeah.
a little surprised to see, you know, like four in one.
Right. Yeah, and it's great when you're leading a field trip, which I often do, when the two are flying together. It's one thing to tell people about two species of vultures, but when they're circling and flying overhead and you can point out the differences, like, okay, that one on the left, look at that, how it's holding its wings. It's different from the one on the right.
Yeah.
And so you can see them flying together, too. So it's not that unusual.
Somebody has got, doesn't he have a kind of a whitish patch on the bottom of his wing?
It's a silvery lining on the tips on the black vulture, and then the entire trailing edge on the turkey vulture has got that silvery lining. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not, you know, my mind ain't going completely.
No, yet. No, you're seeing all the features, and you're seeing them do their thing, which is sometimes getting together and feeding on the same roadkill or carcass or
well,
anything.
Well, this was on the grass.
Yeah.
I imagine somebody hit it with a car and flipped
yeah.
it in there, and I imagine it was a rabbit or maybe a... You know, or maybe a dog or cat.
Yeah, or armadillo. They like those raccoons. I mean, that's yeah. There's something in there.
I'm on a portable because of I've had a couple of trash pandas rip through the screen on our back door onto our porch and going in after the cat food.
Oh wow!
And so I'm putting up some hardware cloth.
Okay.
From you know being able to repeat that. Bit of mission.
Right. Okay.
Tell you what if I catch one of them? If I catch one of them, I'm going to shoot him.
Yeah.
I've decided I've got some 357 Magnum shot cartridges, and that won't you know tear up other things or damage the house to
yeah.
the next block. So.
Right.
But it'll fix the trash panda just fine.
That's
believe.
That's right. All right, Clyde, thanks for the call and enjoy those vultures.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have most of our lines open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have one caller who dropped. If you'd like to get in, now would be the time. We're going to go next to Joel from Kilgore. Joel, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi. Well, first I wanted to say thanks for taking the call, but I've actually got another identifier for you.
Okay.
So I work at a chemical plant in Longview, Texas.
Okay.
There's a lot of gravel. I mean, they've got some forested areas around the edge of the plant and on the outskirts. And on one such venture where I was doing a job on one of those outside units, I spotted this bird that had made it in some sort of nest in the gravel. Now,
okay.
Keep in mind, it's not exactly cold or even temperate outside. It's getting up into the 90s. There's high humidity. So my question is, what kind of a bird makes its nest on the ground like that, and why, as opposed to, you know, being up in the trees where there's more wind, it might be cooler or, you know, safer for their young.
Right. I'm curious, is this the old Eastman, Kodak Eastman property are you talking about?
Yep.
Okay. I've been out there. I've got a couple of birdwatcher friends that spent their careers out there, and that's a great place to go birding. And I can bet you that the bird you're talking about is the killdeer. And Bill has that vocalization. We can pull that up in a minute. But it nests just like what you described, on the rocks, on the ground. It's really hot, and it's the niche it's found. It's a shorebird, and so it's kind of, its affinities are to, you know, nest in the sand and on the ground. And listen to this and see if that sounds like your bird.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, because if you're near the nest, there's mom and dad that is hollering at you, trying to lure you away from the fragile eggs and young. So I'm guessing those are killdeer, and that's just how they do it. They not only nest on gravel roads and driveways and parking lots, they'll also nest on gravel rooftops, flat gravel rooftops. And which is fine. I mean, I don't know how they do it. It's 140 degrees up there probably on the ground. And the interesting part is, if it's a one story, that young, you know, he has to jump off. But if it's multi-story, I don't know how they do it. But they, killdeer are out there and breeding and doing fine. And so the message is, hopefully at your plant there, is to flag those nests that are found and keep the trucks off of them and keep the workers from stomping on them, because, you know, these birds are just trying to make a living like you and me. And if we can avoid them and not hurt them and not step on them, even though it's an accident, we can avoid those accidents. And hey, let me tell you, chemical plant is all about avoiding accidents, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
You know,
thank
OSHA. You've heard of OSHA, right? Yeah. So we need OSHA for birds.
Yeah, they really do. Well,
yeah.
That kind of begs the question, if it's a shorebird, I mean, what brought it, what brings it so far?
Yeah,
it's kind of like North Texas.
Yeah, it's a shorebird that deals with inland settings as well. We have them around our lakes, our reservoirs. They'll be in wet fields. Gotcha. We have them at night. You can find them in parking lots of big box stores as well. So it doesn't have to be the beach. That bird can do well. I've seen them on soccer fields, football fields. They like that short grass areas, and the gravel, wherever they find it, is a great spot to lay their eggs. If you've seen their eggs, they look just like the gravel. They're speckled, they're kind of an olivey gray, and they look just like the rock. So they blend in really well, and it's an easy nest to make. It's what we call a scrape. All the adult does is just kind of scrape away a little bit of the ground, making this bowl shape area out of the dirt and then out of the rocks, and then plop, they lay three or four eggs right there.
And the heat doesn't adversely affect them?
No, actually the heat is a problem, and so the adult birds are doing more of shading than saying, oh, look, you know, if we flush the bird off, the eggs are staying nice and warm because of the sun. Well, in our sun, it can actually cook those eggs, not literally, but, you know, it does get it too hot. So you'll see the adults shading the eggs more than not, and so that's another reason not to flush them off the nest with a truck or walking by, is because then you're exposing those eggs not only to predators but from the hot sun. So the adults are shading those eggs.
Okay, well, thank you for answering
okay.
my question.
Thanks, Joel.
Very informative.
All right, very good.
All right. Thank you, Joel. And we're going to go to our next caller now, as Jenny from, I believe, Henston. Jenny, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, this is a common bird that we see around here. Always wants to make a nest in my garage or right over my eave of my front door.
Uh-huh.
And usually uses a lot of mud.
Okay.
And I usually wait till the eggs have hatched before I get rid of the nest.
Okay.
But this spring, I thought the nest was empty, and it wasn't.
Uh-oh.
And I was cleaning the door off of all the mud, is there any way of keeping them from coming back to that same spot every year? That's what they seem to do.
Yeah, you have to be vigilant. So when they're starting to build the nest, and we're talking about, it's probably a barn swallow, but there's also the eastern phoebe that has less mud, much less mud, but it is a very common porch nester. But I'm guessing what your bird is, a barn swallow, very acrobatic, agile flyers, and the nest is almost 100% made of mud. Does that sound right?
That sounds like the one that's over the front door. The one in the garage is mostly twigs.
Okay, then you probably have one of each. Barn swallow on one and eastern phoebe on the other. So you just have to, first of all, in the winter when no one's nesting, for sure, in the dead of winter, remove whatever's there because they will add to whatever's still available. You'll see phoebes build on top of the nest, old nest. You'll see that that mud crumble down to a little lip. Well, that's that lip is where they'll attach a new nest. So you have to be vigilant in March and April and keep moving away whatever they add to build that nest, because you don't want it to get to completion, because then they lay eggs and then you just don't want to deal with it. And the birds are protected once those eggs are laid.
All right. Thank you very much, Jenny. But we've got to go to one more caller. It's got to be very quick. Jerry, you're online, but we need a very quick question because we've got to get to our close.
Okay. It's just, should be real quick. What I've been seeing, some white birds flying by in the last month or so. And they look like, I mean, they're all white, but there's a few black ones in there.
Okay.
And they look like egrets.
Yep.
But I don't know what kind of egret they are.
Okay. I'm going to guess it's like one of our earlier callers, that the white ones are cattle egrets and the dark ones, the all dark ones, are little blue herons. They're roughly the same size, and it's just a matter of color. So, again, cattle egret is the white one, and little blue heron is the dark one. Yep.
Yeah. Do they flock together?
Yeah. And I mentioned that earlier when I talked about the words. I used the words heronry and rookery. And so these guys nest and roost together in a communal setting. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Jerry, for
calling in
and for everybody for calling in on our five-year anniversary show. And we're going to close out tonight's program with a conservation tip. Cliff, what do you have for us this month?
This month, we're going to talk about providing a nesting and roosting structure for the chimney swift, the species we profiled earlier tonight. Chimney swifts eat pesky insects on the wing, making them great neighbors to have. They're removing winged insects from around our homes and lawns, and their presence is like having a pest control agent visiting for free. The simplest way to provide a home to them is by not capping your chimney. In natural settings, these birds use giant hollow trees that have lost their crown, so just the massive trunk is standing. So in today's urban world, an open chimney can resemble these large tree trunks. I have a couple friends with uncapped chimneys who enjoy the chatterings of swifts each evening during the warmer months when the birds come to roost. Eventually, that chattering turns to silence as the birds sleep quietly through the night. If you want to avoid a swift flying loose in your house, simply close the damper. When your fireplace is not in use, closing that damper is always a good idea to keep out unwanted critters and the weather. If your chimney is capped and you'd like to attract a nesting pair of chimney swifts, but you have no interest in uncapping your chimney, you're still in luck. There are directions on how to build your own chimney swift tower on your property by going to the website chimneyswifts.org. Again, chimneyswifts.org. Bring these pest control agents closer to home. Do it for the birds.
All right. And you've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, whom we'd like to thank. Cliff, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and is brought to you in part by the Piney Woods Audubon Society in Nacogdoches, Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information on Facebook at East Texas Piney Woods Audubon. We'd like to thank everybody for calling in tonight. Bird Calls is produced by Red River Radio. Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford are the producers. We had help tonight from Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, Sheila Lawrence, and Henry Edwards. The audio for tonight's program will be up on our website in a few hours, and we invite you to go there and listen again to redriverradio.org, where you can catch all of our past programs as well. And remember, if you have a photo or sound clip that you'd like to send to Cliff to identify, you can send them to my email address after the show, wbeckett@lsus.edu. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next.